Welcome to American Dissident Voices. I'm Kevin Alfred Strom. Do Jews have a mentality as different from ours as a parasite's is from that of the species on which it feeds? As the cowbird's is from the tanagers, as the leech's is from that of the horse. No question of history and science is more fascinating, and none is more important for our future. No man is better qualified to increase our understanding of this subject than the late, great Professor Revelo Pendleton Oliver, classicist, linguist, scholar, and one of the greatest writers of the 20th century. This week we continue our excerpts from his insightful work on this subject under the title, The Jewish Plague, Part 5. I give you the words of Revelo P. Oliver. The origin of the Jews as a race is unknown, but there are indications that they early began to exploit the superstitions of the populations on which they fastened themselves. The Jews have a tale that their ancestor, named Abraham, came from Ur in Sumeria, with mortgages on half the Sumerians' real estate in his pocket. And some scholars, not highly regarded today, have suggested that some of the Semitic-speaking peoples, with whom the Sumerians foolishly tried to coexist, meddled extensively with the Sumerian religion, and perhaps even had an influence on the white, pre-Aryan civilization of the Indus Valley. There is a firmer basis for a conjecture, but only a conjecture, mind you, that would explain one of the oddities of the New Testament, which was assembled by a Christian sect that professed a religion that was obviously a Judaized form of Zoroastrianism. Everyone has noticed the curious detail that in the story about the birth of the Christ named Jesus, which gives the earlier date for the event, the nativity is said to have been attended by Zoroastrian priests, who were said to have been guided to the spot by an obliging star or planet that floated in the atmosphere at an altitude no greater than that of cumulus clouds to show them the way. It is possible that the Magi, the professional holy men of the religion that was spread through the old Persian Empire, were Jews. The Jews have a tradition that there were colonies of Israelites in Media, in the cities, naturally, and that the Magi not only claimed to come from Media, but were a closed caste racially, and, like the Jews, propagated themselves through the female line, often obtaining pure offspring by impregnating their sisters or mothers. It is now virtually certain that at least the greater part of the extant holy books of the supposedly Aryan religion, although now in an odd dialect of Old Persian, were translated from a Semitic language. Diogenes Laertius mentions in passing unnamed Greek geographers who thought that the Magi were early Jews. But since those works are now lost, we cannot say whether that opinion was based on more than the fact that after the fall of the Persian Empire, many of the Magi who peddled their cult in other lands were known to be Jews. Herodotus' description of the Magophonia, the Persian reaction when one of the Magi attempted a particularly outrageous fraud, sounds very much like a racial outbreak, and Howe and Wells, in their documentary on Herodotus, suggests that the Magi may have been non-Aryan. From these and a few minor traces, one can construct an hypothesis that would be highly significant if there were any real proof of it. Whatever their origin, there cannot be the slightest doubt about the method that the Jews have always regarded as ideal in capturing control of a country. It is set forth clearly and explicitly in the Old Testament. The hero of this tale is a Jew named Joseph, who is said to have been brought to Egypt as a slave, but who cleverly wriggled upward in Egyptian society until he was in a position to prey upon the good nature and superstitions of the Egyptian king, whom he first manipulated to permit an influx of Jews, who somehow take possession of the best land in the nation. Then he uses the king's authority to corner the grain market, and is thus able to take from the Egyptians all their money, all their cattle, and then all their land, so that he has all the Egyptians, except the Egyptian priests, with whom he evidently maintains a prudent but odd alliance, at his mercy. Forces the famished wretches to sell themselves into slavery, and then shrewdly transports groups of the slaves from one end of the country to the other, mixing up the population so thoroughly that all his victims find themselves among strangers with whom they would scarcely dare to concert an effective protest. And the Jews, no doubt snickering in private, annexed property and multiplied exceedingly. Joseph used the Egyptian king as a convenient puppet in this operation, and the tale implies, of course, that he enjoyed the cooperation of his tribe's special god, at least when he was operating as a fortune teller on the way up. It is hard to say how much fact may underlie the story, which is obviously an exposition of the Jews' ideal methods. Some kings of Egypt appear to have been feeble-minded, and there is even a record that one of them admitted some desert nomads who put up a piteous plea that their pastures had dried up. But the principal features of the tale more probably reflect Jewish ambitions than actual events. However that may be, the tale certainly sketches an ideal modus operandi for subjugating the goyim. And the Jews of today will surely not have the audacity to claim that that description of their methods was forged by the secret police of Russia under the czars. The Jews claim that the so-called Protocols of the Elders of Zion, which were certainly published as early as 1904 and reportedly much earlier in books that were destroyed when the Jews seized Russia in 1917, are a forgery. As indeed they may be, although they describe in detail and with complete accuracy the methods that the Jews have consistently used throughout this century to subvert our civilization and destroy our race. But Aryans who wish to understand the Jewish mentality need not rely on that document. They have only to read the Old Testament with minds that are not immobilized in a fog of superstitious awe. There is scarcely a chapter of that pseudo-historical narrative that is not highly revealing. For example, there never was a Persian king named Ahasuerus, but the fiction about Esther is an inspirational apologue to remind Jewesses that while they may find it expedient to marry a male of the lower races, they must always remember their duty to manipulate the stupid goy to exploit him for the advantage of their master race. The racial mentality of the Jews is so different from our own that we can only draw inferences from observation of their conduct and such of their statements as appear more or less candid and worthy of belief. For example, Maurice Samuel's excellent You Gentiles, published in New York in 1924. But we must remember that all forms of life instinctively and necessarily make the preservation and increase of their species their highest purpose. And if vampire bats were capable of reason, they would undoubtedly describe their furtive blood-sucking as a righteous exercise and identify as diabolically evil the various animals, including men, who in one way or another interfere with their noble exercise of their God-given right. No species could think of itself as evil. As an ex-communist once reminded me, quote, "You must remember that when communists betray a nation or murder innocent people by the thousands, they think of themselves as highly moral individuals who righteously obey a higher purpose." Close quote. We may be absolutely certain that whatever the Jews do as a race, no matter how vile and dastardly it may seem to us who suffer its effects, seems to them just and righteous. As indeed it is, if we consider it objectively in terms of the biological law that makes survival and increase the highest law of every species. The Aryans, by the way, are an apparent exception, since everywhere, and most conspicuously in the United States, Britain, and now South Africa, they are evidently driven by a subconscious death wish. The species may be biologically degenerate, or, as the Jews believe, inferior and innately stupid, easily herded by its credulity and cupidity. Some optimists believe that the species could recover its will to live and become viable again if it were somehow to escape the control of its Jewish herdsmen. Before the political murder of Dr. Verwoerd, many rational Americans saw in South Africa a bright hope for our ill-starred race and regarded the Afrikaners as conspicuously intelligent and uncorrupted members of it, attributing their prudence to the fact that they were separated by only a generation from the pioneers who fought an heroic war for independence, and perhaps also to some peculiar integrity in the Dutch Reformed Church, which appeared to have retained some belief in the traditional Christianity of the West at a time when churches elsewhere had been bought and converted into mere instruments of subversion. Since the murder of Dr. Verwoerd, which was made to seem fortuitous to persons who do not understand the rule of cui bono, it has become painfully apparent that the Afrikaners are as gullible and venal, as befuddled and stultified as the majority of British and Americans, that what we mistakenly attributed to a people was only the genius of one man, whose achievements remind one of Philopoemen, who led the Greeks in their last stand for independence, and to whose influence over his decadent and demoralized people, Baudelaire paid tribute in the memorable lines of his earliest poem. Quote, "When they look up to you, they think themselves born for heroic deeds, and with self-confidence that is, alas, excessive, they hope to recover the vigor of their prime and regain their past greatness." Close quote. The great strength of the Jews and the bond of their racial cohesion is their religion, which in the widest sense is an unlimited faith in the absolute superiority of their race. For, as Maurice Samuel reminds us, Jewish atheists who deride a belief in supernatural beings worship the immortal Jewish people. Beyond this, we cannot be definite, for doubtless there has always been the widest gamut of personal belief, and there is every evidence of wild and grotesquely emotional fanaticism among the lower classes, as among the rabble that was stirred up by the numerous gute, or magicians and agitators promoting some religious cult or other, and self-appointed Christs in the 1st century BC and the 1st century of our era, with perennial outbreaks of insane violence. And many Jewish sects have bizarre notions that must be sincerely entertained, as, for example, by the Polish Hasidim, who mated their male and female children as soon as they were puberate to raise the birth rate to the maximum for the express purpose of exhausting God's stock of good Jewish souls as soon as possible, and thus forcing him to bring the world to an end sooner than he intended. But such vagaries among the excitable and irrational lower classes have really little significance for the racial faith. On the other hand, when one turns to the literate Jews, one cannot confidently distinguish between what they believe and what they deem expedient to profess. Fighting between various Jewish sects has often been violent, bloody, and viciously inhuman, but seems not to have been so much over doctrinal differences as over the ambitions of leaders who were ruthlessly slugging it out for power and wealth and used a religious peculiarity to recruit and excite their private armies. And at the limit, we have no assurance that the psychological process that we call belief and distinguish from hypocrisy and mendacity occurs in the Jewish mind, which may not distinguish between truth and falsity in terms of some objective reality, as Arians do, even when the reality is merely a product of their imaginations. So far as we can tell, indeed, the racial mentality of this alien species may, by a psychological process beyond our understanding, think only in terms of what is good for the Jewish people, the divine race, and may only simulate in discourse with our species our distinction between what is objectively true and what is not, much as we train animals by teaching them lessons in terms of their mental conformation, or as we also train superstitious human beings. Ivor Benson gave us an example when he wrote, quote, "In North Africa, during the last World War, one of our tasks was to teach raw Negroes from the jungle to drive 3-ton trucks. Problem number one was how to explain the gears. Common sense produced the answer. Engaging the first gear, the recruits were told, harnessed the spirit of the elephant, slow but very strong, just the sort of power needed to pull a truck up a steep hill or out of mud. The second gear meant the spirit of the horse, a power faster but not as strong as that of the elephant. And moving into top gear, it was the spirit of the antelope which was harnessed, very fast but not of much use in heavy going." Close quote. Now, insofar as this mythology worked with these blacks, it can be said to have been true, or at any rate to have an element of the truth, which could not be conveyed to these primitive minds in any other way. As Benson said, quote, "So far as religious myths are concerned, we are, of course, all in the condition of those African savages." Close quote. Our minds boggle when we try to understand such statements as Rabbi Solomon Goldman's, quote, "God is absorbed in the nationalism of Israel. He, God, creates the world in the Hebrew language." Close quote. Dr. Joseph Kastein's, quote, "It was not God who willed these people, the Jews. It was this people, the Jews, who willed this God." Close quote. or any one of 100 comparable statements, which seem to us to be the ravings of madness, but are only typical of the Jewish mind, which, we must remember, has regularly, throughout history, outwitted our race. We, of course, often remark that men create God in their own image, thus stating a psychological and anthropological truth. And what we mean by that statement is that gods do not exist, but are mere figments of the imagination. And if a man of our race, having thus affirmed his atheism, were then to profess belief in the divinity and reality of a god or gods, we should rightly adjudge him insane. But it is obvious that the Jewish mind sees no illogic in worshiping a god it has knowingly created, in worshiping its own image in a mirror. That is insanity. We cannot honestly call it anything else in our terminology, but it is the insanity of a species that has successfully preyed on all others for millennia, and is now achieving ownership of the entire earth. If we are to be both fair and objective, we must bear in mind the difference, perhaps an enormous difference, between the Jewish mentality and our own. When we consider the Jews' religion and describe it in our terms, we attribute to them, explicitly or by implication, such hypocrisy as we see in our clergymen today, and we are tempted to convict them of a conscious dissimulation that is odious to us. But we must remember that what seems repugnant to us seems good and righteous to their peculiar mentality. There can be no doubt, I think, but that Jews perceive the physical world about us quite differently from our perception of it. Since Jews communicate with our race in Indo-European languages and in the West even use those languages to communicate with each other, although probably attaching different meanings to many key words, or distort Indo-European languages into special dialects of their own, such as their variety of the Greek koine in antiquity and Ladino and Yiddish in more recent times. The vast psychological difference may be most clearly seen when one examines Hebrew, a dialect they formed from Western Semitic, Phoenician, and impressed with their own mentality, since it has many peculiarities not found in other Semitic languages. These are set forth by Dr. Thorleif Bowman in his Hebrew Thought Compared with Greek, a work that deserves the most careful study by Arians. Dr. Bowman is a Christian and thus obligated himself to find a moral value in the radically different Jewish mentality, and a comparable study by an unprejudiced philologist is greatly to be desired. It is entirely possible that the schizophrenic daubs that are peddled to the boobs as modern art actually correspond to the Jewish perception of reality and instinctive hatred of what seems beautiful and noble to us, and should not therefore be regarded as merely a means of corrupting our culture and displaying contempt for us. You've been listening to The Jewish Plague, Part 5, written by Professor Revelo Pendleton Oliver and presented by your host, yours truly, Kevin Alfred Strom. To read more of Dr. Oliver's works, visit nationalvanguard.org/Oliver. That's nationalvanguard, all one word, .org/Oliver. We'll continue this important discussion of the Jewish question by classicist, scholar, and teacher Dr. Revelo P. Oliver next week on American Dissident Voices.